So if you look around the sanctuary here, you'll see lots of different pictures and images of Jesus. And it starts at the back corner there with a picture of his birth and his baptism. And then a symbol of Jesus as the good shepherd, him with the children, and then him rising on the clouds. All pictures often of his life. And then behind me, this large stained glass of him praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. But there's also another picture here on a banner. You think, well, that isn't Jesus, is it? Well, it is. As we look through the book of Revelation, we see him as the Lamb of God. But pictures and images have this power that can do things for us that words can't. I mean, we could have, instead of stained glass, had just a bunch of words on the wall, right? It said, Jesus is the good shepherd. Jesus held the little children in his arms. But those would work differently, wouldn't they? They wouldn't evoke the same image. But today we have, in the reading from the book of Revelation, a very different picture of what Jesus is like. See any pictures like that around here? With like hair like wool, bronze feet, eyes like fire, a sword coming out of his mouth? No, but each one of these pictures is designed for a reason. Each one of these stained glass is designed to remind us in some way of who Jesus is and what he does for us. Reminds us of different things and shapes us in different ways. And John gives us a particular image here, or I should say John is given a particular image here to help us remind us of something. And so today we're going to be looking in the book of Revelation at this image that John saw, this vision that John saw. And so we're in a new series on the book of Revelation. I don't even really like calling it the book of Revelation, the revelation of Jesus Christ, or we could say the letter of Revelation. And so we introduced it last week, and Revelation is this book at the end of the Bible that's filled with all these incredible images and symbols, but it's a letter written to churches, but it's also a prophecy, meaning it's the word of God for a particular situation, but it's also an apocalypse, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. A revealing, an unveiling, a showing of something different. And so this is how we begin the experience in chapter 1, verse 9. It says, I, John, your brother, and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus, was he in the island of Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. And so we have this John, and we're not sure entirely who he is. Maybe the Apostle John, maybe one of the other, some other John. But he's on Patmos. Patmos is this small island off of what we know as Turkey. Maybe 5 miles wide, 10 miles long. Not a very large island. And he's probably in exile there. It sounds like he maybe was preaching, that he was teaching about who Jesus was. And the authorities in Rome, the people in charge, didn't like this message that he was teaching, because he was proclaiming that Christ is Lord. And that contradicted the idea that Caesar is Lord. And so he was sent off to this island rather than being killed, because sometimes when you kill someone, you make them a martyr. And so he's probably exiled to this island, kind of sent away to silence him, as is often done with dissidents through the ages. They're sent off to prison somewhere and put away to go. And he's there, and he describes himself as a brother and companion in the suffering. In other words, he's not simply a scholar, an academic sitting in a tower somewhere giving you a treatise on what it looks like to follow Jesus. But he's a participant in it. He's someone who's been a part of it, and he's sharing in what's going on in the churches. He talks about sharing in the suffering and in the patient endurance. And so he's talking to the churches probably experiencing persecution, but also just the struggles of what it looks like to live as Christians in a society that had so many different values and ideas, and what it looks like to follow Jesus instead of following the ways of Rome. And so what he's talking about is, this is about the real world. He's saying, this is about the here and now. This is about what's going on. Here I am in this. But he also then goes on, he says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And so there's this sense where he's, in one sense, he's in a physical location. He's on the island of Patmos, but in another sense, he's in the Spirit. He's experiencing kind of both worlds at the same time. And so we have this picture of him saying he's being on the Lord's Day, and he was in the Spirit. And earlier in chapter 1, it talks about the seven thrones before the Spirit. And so this is a vision. And so what we're getting is the Holy Spirit's involved in this. The Spirit is what reveals Jesus. And so there he is. As it says, on the Lord's Day, I was in the Spirit, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet. And a trumpet, perhaps, is a great image of, in the book of Exodus, when the people of God come to Sinai after being rescued, it describes God's voice like a trumpet sounding. And so here's this image. And if you remember at Sinai, The people are called to be a kingdom of priests, which is exactly the language Jesus uses here. So it's this call to the people. And it says he is to write and send to the seven churches. And so we're going to talk more about these seven churches in the coming weeks. But these seven churches are, again, in what we kind of call modern day Turkey. And they're kind of listed in what would look like kind of a circular pattern, almost as if you were making a trip or carrying a letter from church to church. This is the order you would visit them in. You would visit Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum and so on. And so, but there's seven of them. And so one of the things we do as we read Revelation is oftentimes when there's a number, there's symbolism behind it. It's got meaning to it. And certainly there's seven if you count them. There are seven churches. But seven in the Bible often typically represents wholeness or completion. So as God created in 6 days, seventh day rested, these seven often refers to that. So earlier, when it talks about the seven spirits before the throne, it's the completeness. And so one of the things we learn to do as we read through Revelation, we see the number seven, we think, oh, it's complete, it's full, it's perfect. So when John is told to write to the seven churches, in other words, he's saying, this is a letter to all the churches. This isn't just for those seven particular churches, but this is a letter to all the churches. And so he's told to write what you see and to send it. He's having a vision. He's having a picture. He's having an image. And what this looked like, how it worked, was it in his head? Was it something he actually saw projected on the walls of the rocks? We don't know. But in some way, he saw this vision, and he's told to send it and to send it to the churches. And then it says, I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. You think, well, wait a minute. I mean, were this lampstand speaking? It wasn't the lampstand speaking, but often this happens in Revelation where he hears something and he sees and something else comes. But there's something I think powerful as he's there and you imagine John and he's on the island. Maybe he's walking and praying or maybe he's standing and looking out and he hears a voice. And if you hear a voice behind you, what are you most likely? You're going to turn and face it, right? Because you want to see who's speaking to you. But there's also a sense, what happens is we turn, we have a whole new perspective. If I'm standing here, I have one perspective on the church. If I turn over here, I've got a whole new perspective. And so, in a sense, John, as he turns, he's getting a new perspective. And that's exactly what happens here. As he begins to have this vision, he, in some sense, enters a new world. He goes from the everyday life, the one who is the companion and suffering in the world, to gain a whole new perspective. And so I mentioned earlier that the book of Revelation is often called an apocalypse. And that's simply, Revelation is the English translation of the Greek word apokalupto, which becomes apocalypse, revelation. And it's an unveiling. And what an apocalypse is it helps us see what's going on right now in light of unseen reality in the present and future. So in other words, it's saying, what we see right now with our eyes, there's more going on. There's something else, and you need to see it from a different perspective. You need to see it in some sense from God's perspective, because when we do, it changes how we see things now. And the way that Apocalypse does this is through images. And that's why I suggest we start with the images, because what images do, what pictures have to do, is they have an ability to go past our intellect. And we tend to sometimes kind of stay up in our head. We put things up in our head. And what images do is can appeal to our emotions. And so we can maybe look at the stained glass of Jesus. They're pouring out his heart, sweating blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. And if we just wrote up on the words, wrote up instead of the stained glass, had something that said, Jesus kneeling by a rock praying. I mean, that's an accurate description of what's going on there, right? But it wouldn't have the same emotion as maybe when you sit and you look at that picture and you see it. And so that's how images work. You go see movies and you see pictures and you see these things and it evokes in us something different. And so one of the reasons I think God uses images in particular, and Richard Baucom, one scholar, talks about that, is because the people, the early Christians, were bombarded by images, just like the way we are. I mean, in an average day, think of all the images that you see. When you drive down the road, there's billboards everywhere. And what are they? They're images, right? And by that, images, I'm using images rather than pictures because images convey something. And so images convey particular pictures. And some of them are telling you, what? This is what will make you happy often, right? I mean, that's the base, that's the fundamental pitch of all advertising is you need this or this will make you happy, or sometimes some combination of those two things. You see images, and maybe it's on the images, and advertising has improved a little bit on this, but it's saying this is the ideal of what it looks like to be a man or to be a woman. You have to have this kind of body shape and this kind of hair, this kind of style, and this is what it looks like to be a perfect person. And so think about those kind of images that are minded. Well, the ancient Christians, they didn't have billboards. They didn't have screens. But what they did have was everywhere around them were images that Rome produced to say, Rome is what you need to pay attention to. Rome is what's in power. They had festivals. And all the festivals, what did all the festivals do? They celebrated the power and the glory of Rome. They had icons. They had statues everywhere. And what kind of statues were they? Idols. Yeah, well, not just idols, but oftentimes they were the Caesars. And they weren't the Caesars like holding a lamb in their arms, were they? They were the Caesars with the sword. And a number of weeks ago, I kind of made this reference and this throwaway line about there's always some dude on a horse, which is from a pastor that I listened to around. And his point was, as he was talking about this, was if you travel around the world and go to many nations and capitals of the world, what do you see? You see a statue, and often there's a statue and there's a guy up on a horse with a sword. As Brian Zahn puts it, there's always some dude on a horse. And that, what is it? That's a picture of people in power. And so if you were in Rome and you were walking, everywhere you looked, you would see statues of Caesar, and Caesar was holding a sword, or Caesar was standing big with a crown, which was an image which told you something. What? That Caesar is in control, that Caesar is a powerful, that the might of Rome, the power of Rome is the power of the sword. And so there were all these images that shaped your mind to think and to see the world in a certain way, and in some sense, to see it the way Rome saw it. And so when Jesus gives a vision to John, what he wants John to do is to see the world the way God sees it, to see it from a different perspective. And so Richard Bauckham says it this way. He says, Revelation provides a set of Christian prophetic counter images. In other words, images counter to what Rome did, which impress on the readers a different vision of the world. So shaping the world, shaping our mind in a different way. The visual power of the book, in other words, the book of Revelation, affects a kind of purging of the Christian imagination. It takes the way we've been shaped by the world around us. We're not seeing the images of Rome. We're seeing the images of Wall Street and of the United States and of all the centers of power that we live in. We see those images and we have to have them purged. And then not just wiped out. It's not just all those images taken out, but then refurbished with an alternative vision of how the world is and will be. So God uses these images given in the book of Revelation to kind of reshape our imagination, the way we see the world. Takes out what's going on in the world around us, what the world has fed us, and gives us a different version. So one scholar compares how these images work to political cartoons. And so we think about political cartoons often say much more than we say or do. So I'm going to put a couple up here just quickly. We're not going to analyze. I tried to pick some that were fairly neutral here. But so there's this one from a few years ago. So you can see the elephant and the donkey, and it talks about the budget deal mistletoe, and they're kind of got their breath, they don't want to get it. I mean, it evokes an image. You could write a script that says, oh, the Republicans and Democrats, they're struggling to get along, but they kind of make a deal because they have, but this says something different. Or there's this one. This is written a number of years ago, the 113th Congress. I mean, look at him there. He's so proud of the bulb he's got up on the tree. And beneath the tree is what? All these shattered balls, all these mistakes. And so it evokes a picture and an image much more than we could say, well, Congress doesn't get along very well, but they did get this one little thing done, didn't they? Or this one here, which is a great one. If I were to just simply say, oh, two fists reaching out across, I mean, it's not that. It's saying something more, isn't it? Because the picture, the image, says more than even the words of it, as we see these two fists of representing the United States and China and a trade war and a war going on, all these different things. Things that can say much more in an image than we could say with words. So you notice how they work. They work in our imagination. I mean, we're not necessarily supposed to imagine literally there are two giant fists reaching across the Pacific Ocean. But we see instead what? Fists represent conflict. And there was, you can see almost ice drop dripping from them, or symbol of the Cold War. So there's this picture going on. And that's what these images in Revelation. Now, he certainly doesn't suggest these are much more than political cartoons. There's much more going on in Revelation. But they invite us to see the world in a different way. So we begin with, what does John see? Remember, he's there, he's in the Spirit on the Lord's day, he hears a voice, and he turns, and what does he see? Seven golden lampstands. And so we might think of the lampstands from the book of Exodus, the seven branch, but what's a lamp? What do you do with a lampstand? I mean, what's the function of a lampstand? Put a light on it, right? I mean, it's a lampstand. I mean, it says it right in the name, right? It's a stand for a lamp. And so even Jesus uses that same image back in Matthew chapter 5 when he says, you know, you don't hide a light under a bushel. What do you put it on a lampstand, right? And so here he looks and he sees a lampstand, in other words, a pedestal to put a light on. And if we're confused about what exactly those lampstands are, he actually goes on and explains it down in verse 20, where he says the mystery, and mystery is a particular word. It isn't like a murder mystery. Mystery in the Bible is something that was previously unknown that's now revealed by God. He said, the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven gold lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So in other words, he sees seven lampstands, but Jesus says to him, he says, the lampstands, that's the churches. And so we get a picture, well, what are the churches supposed to do? They're supposed to be lampstands. They're supposed to hold the light up. And then he goes on and he says, there's someone there. It's not just lampstand. He says, and among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe, reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. And so here's a picture. He says, notice he says, someone like a son of man. And so it's evoking a particular image, but it's not all of it. And most likely this image of a son of man comes from Daniel 7. I'm not going to put it all up on the screen, but I want you to hear this vision that Daniel had. So Daniel is this Old Testament prophet. He had been sent into exile into Babylon. And while he's there, God gives him a vision. And this is a part of his vision. And I want you to hear the vision that Daniel saw and think of the vision that John sees and notice the similarities. Begins, as I looked. And so again, thrones were set in place and the Ancient of Days took his seat. This is Daniel chapter 7, beginning verse 9. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. And then he says, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. And so John turns, he looks, he says, I see one like a son of man. And all those images begin to come to mind, this one who's there. But one of the things we notice about the son of man was what? He was one who was what? Given dominion over everything. And so he sees this person who's given dominion about him. And it goes on. He says, dressed in a robe, reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. The hair on his head was white like wool. We heard a little bit of that in Daniel. But it wasn't the Son of Man, it was the Ancient of Days. As white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice like that of the sound of a rushing waters. In his right hand, he held seven stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all of its brilliance. I want you to try and draw that, please. I mean, that's just but I think what John is doing, he's not necessarily encouraging to us to literally envision this, but there's all these pictures of what's going on. I mean, we see him dressed in a robe, and we're going to come back to some of these images in the coming weeks and look at them more specifically because there's some unique connections between the churches. So I'm just going to kind of highlight some of these. But we see these pictures of him wearing a robe and a sash. He's a priest and a king. Hair and beard like white as wool. What does that tell you? Is he a young guy? No, I mean, he's old. I mean, this is like, I mean, kind of the stereotypical hair like wool, white like wool. I mean, he's really old. And it doesn't mean like he's old in the sense of like, oh, he's an old decrepit guy. What is it? It's this symbol of wisdom and power. Feet like bronze. Voice like waters. And again, kind of these all these pictures that are invoking his sense of power. He's holding the future. He's drawing from Isaiah, from Ezekiel, from Daniel, from Judges. He's got a sword in his mouth. I mean, that's a weird way to talk, isn't it? His voice is like waters, but he's got a sword coming out of his mouth. And the sword will come up other times. But the sword we associate with this word of power. And so what we're designed, if nothing else, we're encouraged to, is there's this incredible image of who he's seeing. This is who Jesus is. Is this picture, the Son of Man and all these fantastic things around him. Does he look like any of these here? No, because Jesus is presenting himself. He's inviting us to see him, an image of him for a particular reason. And he's where? Where is he? He's standing in the midst of the lampstands. And the lampstands are what? The churches. So there's Jesus in the midst of the churches. And he's saying, in the midst of the churches is one like a Son of Man, one who is Ancient of Days, one who has power, one who has authority, one who has dominion, one who, and in some sense, what he's pointing to is, I have control, I have power. So churches, I want you to look to me. I'm in the middle of you. I'm not standing on the outside. I'm not looking in, but here I am in the middle with all that I am, the one like Son of the Son of Man who has dominion over all things. And I'm there in the midst of the churches. Not only is being in the midst of the churches a source of hope, but it means he knows what's going on. When you're in the middle of something, we use that same language, almost like somebody's in the middle of something. In some sense, what he's saying is like, I know what's going on. And that's exactly in the next few weeks as Jesus speaks to these churches. He can speak to them with authority because he's in the middle of them. He knows what's going on. And he can speak to them with authority and tell them the things they need to do and change because he's the Ancient of Days. He's the one with the hair. He's the one with the bronze feet and the voice like waters and the sword coming out of his mouth. He's the one who speaks the word of God. And then there's the kind of whole thing. I'm not sure most people don't want to do. Like, he's holding his hand. You notice he's holding in his hand something. He says the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. Nobody really knows what to do with that. But in some sense, the angels, most likely he means little spiritual beings of the churches, in some sense representing the fact that maybe there's a particular angel over a church. We don't do much with that, and it doesn't really show up again. But he's, notice what he's, where has he got him? He's got him in his hand. And when you have something in your hand, they're under his control. And so when we see this image, we can try and break it all down, or we can let the emotions and the vision overpower us and say, what he sees is Jesus with all power, with all dominion, with all authority, standing in the midst of the churches, knowing what's going on and able to speak words of power, confidently holding them in his hand. And so when John sees this, he says, well, I fell at his feet as though dead. I mean, like, if I saw that, I'd freak out too. I mean, he says, then he placed his right hand on me and said, do not be afraid, I am the first and the last. So notice, John's response is natural. But what does Jesus do? Puts his hand on him. It's this sense of personal touch. And this hand that's been holding the angels, it's in some sense an image of prophecy being given to him, of this prophetic gesture, but this personal touch. He says, don't be afraid. Because I would begin to get a little bit worried. And to say, what's this guy going to do to me? What's going to happen? But he goes on, he says, I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. So he was living. He's not dead, but alive now forever. And then he says, and now look. And this phrase shows up a whole bunch of times, about 19 or 20 times in the book of Revelation, where John is invited to look, or where the reader or the listener is invited to look. Or in some translations I like better, it says, lo, or behold. And I think this is important because that's what Revelation is inviting us to do, is to look. It's inviting us to listen, to see things differently. And when we do, it gives us courage and it gives us hope. What are we invited to see? The one who is alive forevermore, the one who holds the keys of death and Hades, the one who has the power over death. But also in some sense, by saying death and Hades or death in the grave, he's saying everything that's in opposition to God, he holds the keys. He's in control. And so it's this sense of confidence. We're invited to see Jesus and allow all these images to reshape our imagination, our way of seeing the world. We're called to be witnesses, to be lights, to disciples. And what are we reminded of? Reminded that we have security. I mean, it's this incredible confidence for Fruitland Covenant Church in 2024. If we imagine, we are a lampstand. We're designed to be a place that shines the light for God. And it can be tempting. It can be easy to fall into the trap and look around and say, look at all the forces. Look at all the things that are pressing down in the church, the things that are going counter to the world, to maybe worry about a budget, to do all these things. And what Jesus says is, I'm standing here in the middle of you. And who's the one standing in the middle of us? The one whose hair is light white like snow, the one who is the Ancient of Days, the one whose feet are like bronze, the one whose voice is like the waters, the one who holds the seven stars in his hands, the one who rules over all kingdoms. He's here in the midst. In some sense, he says, what? Don't be afraid. Don't worry. I'm here in the middle of you. What he's inviting us to do is to shift our eyes and see from a different perspective. Because it can be tempting in a church to get our eyes fixed on the wrong things. To look and to begin to worry, to say, oh, look what the government's doing. Look at the way they're taking prayer away. Look at the way they're treating Christians. Look at all these things going on. And Jesus says, don't look at those. Look at me. And I'm standing here in the middle of the things. I am the first and the last. I was dead and I am alive forever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. In other words, don't be afraid. Stop worrying about those things. Instead, fix your eyes on him. Allow your imagination to be shaped by that picture and to say, we have security. And we're not to be afraid. But he's also offering us a picture of hope. Because he says, the one who was dead is now alive forever and ever. And earlier he said he's the firstborn, which means that it is for us as we share it as witness. He's the firstborn, meaning there's more to come. So it's this picture of the church. The picture of the church that Jesus is inviting us to see. He's inviting us to see ourselves as lampstands. To see ourselves as people who hold up the light. What? The light of Jesus. And the rest of the book, in some sense, is a story, images that invite us to say, what does it look like to be a lampstand? What does it look like to shine the light of Jesus? It's an image that calls us to find our security in Jesus, to see things from a different perspective, to turn our eyes from all the images around us that are telling us something different, images that are calling us often to be afraid. That's so much we get. I said advertising. Advertising often is shaped around what? Around the image of like, you need this or it'll make you happier. When you get the appeals for money in the mail, particularly from politicians, what's one of the single primary messages? Be afraid, right? If the other side gets in power, who knows what's going to happen? It's going to be horrible. It's just be afraid. Be afraid because this is what they're going to do to your churches. This is what they're going to do to your schools. This is what they're going to do to your country. This is what they're going to do to your rights. This is what's going to happen. And Jesus says, stop being afraid. Get your eyes off that and get your eyes on me. And then he says, not only do you have security in me, but you have hope in me. You have hope in me because I am the first and the last. I was dead, but I am now alive forevermore. And I hold the keys of death. So you don't have to be afraid. He's reminding these churches that were facing literal chance of death for their witness. The same thing that some of our sisters and brothers around the world still do, who can, by simply the virtue of having a Bible, by preaching the good news of Jesus, can be put to death. And he says, look at me. I hold the keys of death. He said, they may put you to death, but they can't keep you there. And that's a picture of hope. Because, in other words, what he's saying, whatever the government, whatever the powers, whatever you see as the forces and oppression to you, there is nothing they can do to you that will do you permanent harm, because I hold the keys of death. So this week, I invite you to turn your eyes to that Jesus. May we see him as he is, the one who stands in the midst of the churches, the one who is the first and the last, the one who was dead but is now alive forevermore, the one who holds the keys of death and the grave. May we see him, and may we have security and hope. Amen.